Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
This is World Report. Good morning, I'm John Northcott. The Alberta government has introduced a bill that could give it more power over municipalities. If passed, the bill would give greater control to the province over how municipal elections are run and also more authority over local officials. As Julia Wong reports, critics say that's a problem.
Bill 20, entitled the Municipal Affairs Statutes Amendment Act.
Alberta Municipal Affairs Minister Rick McIver says the goal of the bill is to create more transparency and accountability in local politics. It paves the way for political parties on the municipal level, specifically Edmonton and Calgary as part of a pilot project, and would ban automated voting machines. If passed, the bill would also give cabinet powers to remove councillors in the name of public interest, but that term has not been defined.
What's in the public interest would be a case-by-case basis.
The bill could also allow Alberta's cabinet to force municipalities to repeal or amend bylaws the province doesn't like, powers that McIver hopes never have to be used.
The cabinet can't explain it in a way supported by facts why they would make such a decision, then they shouldn't make it. That's a high standard.
For Eric Adams, a law professor at the University of Alberta, the bill is worrying.
These things are not publicly debated. It means that there won't be opposition parties that are able to ask questions about why that is happening.
The new powers cabinet could have are anti-democratic, says Edmonton City Councillor Andrew Knack.
The way it's written right now sounds like it's very much about intimidation and silencing.
And Calgary Mayor Jody Gondek says there are more questions than answers with this legislation.
I think it's bordering on overreach in many cases.
If the bill is passed, the Alberta government says it will develop regulations in consultation with municipalities in the coming months. Julia Wong, CBC News, Edmonton.
Air Canada is apologizing for an incident involving a sacred headdress belonging to the Assembly of First Nations National Chief Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak. The crew actually tried to take the item away and stow it in the plane's cargo hold. Linda Ward is on the story for us this morning. Linda, take us through what happened and where Air Canada appears to have gone wrong.
Well, John, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak normally travels with the headdress in a case on her lap or in carry-on storage. But on a flight Wednesday, Air Canada staff took it away, put it in a plastic bag and tried to put it into cargo storage because they said there was no room in the cabin. She says the situation got tense. Words were exchanged with her staff and other passengers then intervened. She complained. The pilot came out and brought the case back. Woodhouse-Nepenak then took to social media and said in a statement, Air Canada needs a protocol for First Peoples so that we're not harassed for our sacred items. Our headdresses, she says, don't belong in garbage bags by airlines. Now, Woodhouse-Nepenak received the headdress for her work on Indigenous child welfare. The AFN says this is one of the highest honors that you can get, and the eagle feathers are blessed to support leaders in their travels.
Yeah, and it is a remarkable looking headdress with those eagle feathers. It's quite tall. So what are you hearing in terms of reaction to this morning?
Well, for many in the Indigenous community specifically, this isn't surprising. Barbara Nepenak is an Indigenous elder and knowledge keeper, and she spoke with the national chief about the incident.
She's obviously been violated, or her space has been violated. It's very disheartening at this time. Here we are 2024, and we're still, I guess, we'll continue to battle with this for as long as we live.
Air Canada has issued a statement in response saying they've reached out to the national chief to better understand and apologize, saying Air Canada understands the importance of accommodating customers with items and symbols of sacred cultural significance. They say that they are reviewing their policies, but we're also hearing from the federal transportation minister who says this is unacceptable and the government expects Air Canada to treat Indigenous customers with respect.
Linda Ward joining us in studio. Thanks, Linda.
You're welcome.
A Quebec family says it has finally located their loved one's remains after the wrong body was sent back to them from Cuba. Faraj Al-Jarjour died last month on vacation in Varadero. Somehow his remains were sent to Russia. Allison Northcott has the details.
He told me, your father in Russia, it's like in a town, North Moscow.
After days of desperate calls looking for answers, Karam Jarjour says the Canadian government has confirmed his father's body ended up in Russia and that he's been buried. He says Canada is working to bring his remains home.
We need to wait like more time now. The situation is
complicated
now because they're going to talk with the government, you know. It's like protocol.
Faraj Al-Jarjour died of a heart attack last month while vacationing with his family in Cuba. His family paid $10,000 to the Canadian government to facilitate the transfer of Jarjour's remains back to Canada through a Cuban agency. But they were sent the wrong body. The Cuban government has since apologized. Jarjour's daughter, Miriam, says now all they can do is wait. It's like someone has tied my hands, she says, and I can't do anything. The family says it's spoken directly with Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly. The federal government says its consular services and global affairs continue to help and support the family. Jarjour's funeral was supposed to be this week, but it was cancelled, and the family is still waiting to find out when they'll be able to say a proper goodbye. Allison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
In Haiti, the new transitional council is now tasked with picking a new prime minister and cabinet. Political stability remains elusive there, and gangs control large areas of the country. But about 1,000 Kenyan troops are preparing to go in. Soldiers from Jamaica, Belize, and Bahamas will support the mission, and Canadian troops are there helping to get their forces ready to go. Paul Hunter reports from Jamaica.
At a small military camp just outside the main airport in Kingston, Jamaica, rows of green army tents sit inside barbed wire fencing as a military helicopter cuts across the sky overhead. It's the late stages of a month-long training program by Canadian forces helping troops from Jamaica, Belize, and Bahamas prepare for a deployment to Haiti. The training is to help troops from the three Caribbean countries act as a support team for troops from Kenya, who are expected to lead the way into Haiti, which has been spiraling ever more out of control, with well-armed paramilitary groups having effectively taken control of the capital. From Canada, the training has included first aid in a combat zone and peacekeeping. And on this, the final day of training for the roughly 300 Caribbean troops, Mission Commander Tariq Massous, deployed from Ottawa, told CBC News,
"Yes, I feel good about it. It is absolutely a tremendous commitment by Canada, and we delivered on that commitment, and I hope that we made our Canadians back home proud."
Exactly when the Kenyan troops and those now trained by Canadians will go in remains unclear, but, says Massous,
"We achieved our goal."
Paul Hunter, CBC News, Kingston, Jamaica.
The second phase of voting is underway in India. About 160 million are expected to cast their ballots as the world's biggest election rolls on. And the campaign appears to be taking a divisive turn, with political observers saying religious polarization is taking center stage. Priyata Brajabachi has more from New Delhi.
Nearly every day this week, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has made the same claim in his election speeches, accusing his rivals of wanting to prioritize the welfare of Muslims over that of Hindu citizens.
My rivals will collect all your wealth and distribute it amongst those who have more children. They will distribute it amongst the infiltrators. Should your hard-earned money be given to the infiltrators?
This was a reference to India's 200 million Muslim community. And critics say Modi is peddling anti-Muslim rhetoric to bolster his position with the country's majority Hindu voters. Modi has defended himself by saying he's simply speaking the truth. India's main opposition party, the Indian National Congress, has denied they have any such plans of redistributing the wealth of the nation. The party's de facto leader, Rahul Gandhi, said this in response.
For the first time in the history of India, a political party has attacked India's constitution with an aim to destroy it.
5 days after Modi made the comments, the Election Commission of India finally wrote to Mr. Modi's party, asking for an explanation on Thursday. But the opposition has accused the body tasked with holding free and fair polls in the country of leniency, furthering allegations of the government misusing federal agencies. Political experts say polarizing voters ahead of elections is a familiar tactic of Modi's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, one that works in their favor by consolidating the majority Hindu votes. Priyata Brajbasi for CBC News, New Delhi.
And that is the latest national and international news from World Report. I'm John Northcott. This is CBC News.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.